Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Sports Odds and Ends. I am one of your co-hosts, Jay Veazey. I am joined by my good friend and co-host, King Kaz. How are you doing, Kaz?
I'm doing well.
All right, that was
pretty
emphatic.
Much it. Yeah, no, fucking, I'm so tired. I spent the weekend in New York walking around looking at shit. Ended up in a hotel that was near the Met Stadium, and then took me a long time to realize it was the Met Stadium. Because fuck the Mets.
All right.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Speaking of, to jump in,
any thoughts on the rumor that popped up last week about James Dolan possibly looking to be the next owner of the Mets? Any opinions on that?
No, none. I mean, no.
What if him becoming the Mets owner requires so much of his time that he decides to sell the Knicks?
He wouldn't, right? It would just be another up you to just New York fandom in general. Because it would be like, not only do I own the basketball franchise that most of New York cares about, now I have this other franchise that the other half of New York cares about. Like, and now they have to incur my wrath too. Like,
and Madison Square Garden, and he's just inextricable from New York, kind of like Michael Bloomberg and Donald Trump. So, well, other baseball news, spring training has started. Today, Jose Altuve got hit by a pitch. That's just the beginning, probably. More on that later. It's going to be an ongoing thing.
So we said this was probably going to be a thing for the Astros and some of their players. Was there was going to be a lot of retaliation. There was going to be a lot of emotion. There was going to be a lot of feelings. And this is usually on the baseball diamond how those things are expressed.
I mean, if you don't punish them with the rules, then the players are going to take it upon themselves to punish them in other ways. All right. Well, that's baseball for now. Moving on to football. We've been talking about the XFL a lot, and XFL attendance is, the numbers are in, and things are looking pretty good.
So this is attendance for games. We talked about the viewership and how that's doing. So what are we looking at numbers wise? How are they getting people in seats? Are they doing at getting people in seats?
17,000 to 18,000 a game so far. That's like a basketball game right there.
Yeah.
Like a sold out basketball game in some places. That is more people that then show up to Kings games regularly. And so it's a fairly small sample size. It's only a couple of weeks, but it's nice to see that these numbers are kind of holding steady for the first couple weeks of the season, and not just massively dropping off. It's kind of a sign that everybody believes in this product and is excited to go see a game, even if they only go to one game or so this year. There's still enough people that like the novelty hasn't worn off in the first week, and that's something that we were kind of we were worried about, or we were wanting to keep an eye on. Seattle came in hard. They brought 29,000 people to their first game, which is not unlike the enormous numbers that they bring to other sports, including soccer. And I think they've kind of had a chip on their shoulder ever since the Seattle Supersonics got taken away. So it just seems like every other sport now has just overwhelming attendance,
especially for Seattle. Like, right, every other sport, like where they've gained a team, like when they gained their soccer team, like they really came out, they showed a lot of support for it, you know, and made it one of the bigger teams in MLS. And it seems like they're kind of doing the same here with the XFL.
Yep. Even though they have the Seahawks there as well, which they are incredibly crazy for as well, that they want to prove that they're they're great fans and that they're loud fans, and so they show up, and you know, Seattle's a fun place to be, which is why all your favorite streamer friends are moving there. Good for Seattle and good for the league as well.
Yeah. All right. So enough XFL. Let's talk about the big dog in the room, the NFL. So we've been talking about the collective bargaining agreement that the NFL ownership has been, or part of the collective bargaining agreement that the ownership has been bringing, which is one more game on the season, the 17th game. And we have some news from that.
Yeah, I mean, 17 games and then expanded playoffs. That's kind of the idea that has been battered around. And the big idea being that, like, okay, they're going to make a bunch of concessions to the players in return for this one thing that the players are absolutely dead set against. And it looked like they came to some sort of tentative agreement. But it seems like after a little bit more talk, the players seem to be divided into three camps, kind of the ones that like a third of them are willing to accept the deal as is, a third of them are wanting to make a couple changes, and then a third of them are just still dead set against playing 17 games. So
yeah,
so this is something that they're probably going to have to resolve, but this upcoming season, because the current collective bargaining agreement expires in March 2021. So that doesn't happen, we could be seeing another work stoppage, a lockout, or mm-hmm. a strike of some sort. But it seems like the owners are dead set on getting 17 games. And I think they were so dead set that I think the players were kind of surprised that they agreed to their other demands, and kind of it's one of those negotiation things where, like, if you put forth a proposal and then the other side just agrees right away, then you start second guessing yourself and thinking, like, did I ask for enough? So I think that's kind of where the players are right now. This has to be ratified by 2/3 of the players' union. So if they don't get that kind of majority support on this, then it's back to the drawing board.
Yeah. So I guess for fans, as we are, where do you feel this is going to end up falling?
It kind of ends up falling wherever the rich people want it to fall, usually. Mm-hmm. Which, that's the owners; they're the ones with the deep pockets. And they're the ones in the position to say, we just want to give you more of this entertaining product that you like. So when it comes to trying to get fan support for this kind of thing, it's you know, I think some fans can see like the big picture that, yeah, like the players don't want to risk more injury, and the league seems to be trending in the direction of more injury if they add more games to the season. But I think the owners are just going to dig in and say, the players just don't want to play ball here. These guys are millionaires and they don't want, they're being paid millions of dollars just to play a game. And you guys work hard at your existing jobs and you guys don't even get paid that much money. And these players are ungrateful. Like, that stuff always gets thrown around every time there's a labor stoppage, and it's kind of tired, and like every time that comes around, it's like every fan that parrots those arguments seems to forget that they are backing billionaires over millionaires, and so to all of us it seems like these are people that are getting paid way more than they should be to play or manage a game. But at the same time, we still like pay a bunch of money to see these people. So I don't know, the owners tend to win out in these sorts of things. Unfortunately, because personally, I don't pay to watch the owners own the team. I pay to watch billionaires play this game.
Yeah.
Because they're very good at it.
Do you think there is a place that is a happy medium?
Yeah, probably. I think like they're going to get their 17 games, and that seems like that's the most important thing to them. And I think there's been ideas thrown around of like, okay, maybe this is like you play a 17 game season, but each player only is allowed to play for 16 of those games. So then you got to juggle your roster around. One of those weeks, you got to throw out your backup quarterback. Or maybe if your quarterback gets injured, then like, you know, that uses up their off game, or something like it's, you know, we could do that. You could, they could maybe get some more safety concessions if they're concerned about, you know, whether this game, this extra game is going to impact their safety. They are already removing games from the preseason as part of this, so that can limit injuries somewhat, but sometimes when these players play, especially like the players that you normally see during the regular season, they're only playing a quarter of a game during the preseason, during a preseason game anyways. So, so it's not much of a concession when it comes to that, but I guess it's more meaningful games, less meaningless games, for at least the players that expect to stay in the league for a long time. I there's always the possibility that they shift more of the currently, I think 48% of the revenue or football related revenue goes towards the player salaries. So maybe if they were to tweak that number up a little bit, in favor of the players, then they would be more willing to accept an extra season or an extra game during the season. So these are the kind of tweaks that happen. So even though both sides seem dead set on certain things, there's still some middle ground here to play with.
Okay. I think so too. I think there could be a happy medium that can be reached. I think we're in this stage right now where as the GM said, it's you know, billionaires over millionaires. But I think there can be a place where everybody is somewhat happy. Obviously, cities tend to lose out in the end with the amount of money that they allocate to these things. But hopefully there's something that kind of makes everybody somewhat happy.
Guys,
all right.
Before we go on to the next story, one quick thing about all of this, because I think about the fact of the possibility that there could be a work stoppage in the National Football League. Then all we'll have to talk about is the XFL for football.
The XFL, the Canadian Football League, you know. So I don't know what ground this holds, especially for something like football, but there was a very interesting kind of YouTube video I watched the other day where they were talking about the rise and fall of street ball as a counter programming to what the NBA was at the time, and the rise and fall of an and one in that. And they were like, one of the things that helped the rise of street ball and one and all these like street tournaments that were going on with that at that time was the stoppage of the NBA at the time.
Yeah.
The NBA had a work stoppage, and a lot of those and did street ball stuff for a little while. And it helped its popularity grow even further. So maybe that's something here that if we see a work stoppage that happens,
DJM says it didn't help slam ball, but okay. I mean, that's a little bit further away from basketball when you got trampolines out on the court. But it's like I think there's a lot more similarities between the XFL and the NFL than there are between the really gimmicky versions of a sport and the sport that they're trying to replace. I wonder if the XFL would try to. I mean, they currently do have a pretty decent relationship with the NFL, and with the NFL's broadcasters. So I think they wouldn't try to like try to like shoehorn themselves in there. Currently, their season does not play at the same time as the NFL.
Well, yeah, no, so. I don't think you necessarily start to move your programming. I think what you do is you allure the names to short-term contracts that are big, bright stars in the NFL. You're like, hey, you're not going to be playing for this time anyway. Why not take a 12-month, a one-year deal, you know, make some money, come play in the XFL, right? So now you
I just don't think they have enough money to do that.
It depends on the situation, right? It depends on the situation. It depends on how it's offered. But once again, a wait and see. So let's move on from there. I know it's going to come up, but we're going to talk about marijuana in the NFL.
And not from a safety perspective a drug testing perspective. Although this is kind of an old story, but it's relevant now. DGM actually brings up a pretty good point that is one of the potential bargaining chips in these collective bargaining talks, that like, okay, we're going to stop testing for marijuana. You guys, instead of getting addicted to painkillers, now you guys can try marijuana instead to treat yourself if it is legal in your state. Which is a mixed bag.
Which also just goes for me right back to the millionaires, billionaire things. And it's probably because some of these team owners own fucking dispensaries or fucking some kind of miracle marijuana shit. Like whatever.
I mean, it's everything becomes legal once white people want to sell it. So it's like, well, so for now, Ohio is like they've medical marijuana is allowed in Ohio. So now they've got to figure out like what does and does not qualify for as like a legitimate medical use for marijuana, and it ended up in front of a medical panel at some point to evaluate whether being a fan of the Cincinnati Bengals or the Cleveland Browns was enough to justify medical marijuana use, and unfortunately they ruled it is not enough. That happened a couple weeks ago, but that's kind of relevant now because Browns offensive tackle Greg Robinson was arrested at a checkpoint in Texas with 157 pounds of marijuana. If you thought you heard me wrong, I want to reiterate that is 157 pounds. That is more than I weigh. That is more than a welterweight boxer weighs, or a welterweight fighter of any sort. I'm stealing this joke from somebody, but if Greg Robinson's weed stash wanted to fight Conor McGregor, it would fail to make weight. That is a lot of weed, and 22 pounds is kind of the threshold for possession with intent to distribute.
Yeah.
So this is a street value of, and I'm pulling these numbers from this article, but 157 pounds is estimated at roughly $500,000 in street value. The story of how he got caught is kind of weird too, because Robinson and his fellow football player, I don't think he's in the league right now, but Quan Bray hired an Uber driver that they knew to drive them from Los Angeles to Louisiana with all this weed stuffed in duffel bags. And
yeah, that just nothing about that sounds good. Right.
And, then they apparently didn't tell him that they were doing this. And then when they approached this checkpoint, which apparently is, at least from the Reddit thread about this, is a checkpoint that everybody knows about and everybody knows to steer clear from. So it was dumb that they were there in the first place. Robinson told Bray to take over driving as they approached the checkpoint. I'm not sure how that would have helped. But then they also said that if they got caught, the Uber driver should claim that the weed was his, which I don't know, like, I like you guys, but like,
no, that's the one. You're either trying to bully the guy, or two, you're like, hey, look, we can pay you enough that you could take that hit, right?
Yeah,
it's like no.
That's not a thing you just do for a friend. It's
right.
Like, it has to be a transaction of some sort. And this guy was having none of it. Let's also remember
letter by the law, right? That is more than triple the amount that qualifies for attempt to distribute, right? So you are at that point at federal level crime. Like,
yeah. Greg Robinson is facing 20 years in prison for this.
Right.
That's
so there is no amount of money that you could possibly offer me to do 20 years in prison for you. Yeah. no matter who you are out there, I don't think there is enough money for me to do a 20-year stint.
And if you're rich enough to pay somebody off, yeah, not even Curly. If you're rich enough to pay somebody off, you are rich enough to pay for your own lawyer to get your ass to get that 20 years pled down to something more reasonable, because I don't think anything is gonna get you out of the fact that you got caught at a checkpoint trafficking 157 pounds of an illicit substance. All discussions about whether it should or should not be legal aside, this was not a very smart decision. It just a massive risk that, another joke that I'm stealing from somebody on Twitter is that Greg Robinson lost two jobs that day, his job as a weed trafficker and his job as a well-paid offensive tackle for the Cleveland Browns. But then again, on the bright side, he doesn't have to play for the Cleveland Browns anymore. So
maybe this was his way out. All right. That's ridiculous. We're going on from there. We're going to talk about one of the big fights that happened over the weekend. I didn't see this one, but you both saw this.
It felt like a fight of the century in a way.
It really did.
So we're talking about Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder.
We talked about Wilder in the past as being the one punch knockout type of fighter, and so Tyson Fury was the last person to not lose to him.
Their first fight ended in a quote unquote controversial draw. It was hotly contested. It went to the scorecards. There were knockdowns on both sides, and the rematch was pretty huge. This is about as much buzz and talk as the heavyweight championship of the world has had since the days of Lennox Lewis and Mike Tyson. This was a big deal. This was a heavyweight fight that had a lot of hype, had a lot of talk, and had a lot of discussion on it. I personally called Tyson Fury by knockout in the eighth. JVZ, what'd you say you had?
I had Deontay Wilder with a knockout just at any point. I actually bet a dollar on it and lost.
But in the end, as JVZ said, Tyson Fury beat Deontay Wilder by knockout. His corner threw in the towel in the seventh round, and it was in the seventh round, so I was off by one. I was that close.
Yep.
But JVZ, just from my impression of the fight, Tyson Fury pretty much dominated, and he got Wilder with one really hard shot in the fourth round that it seemed like Deontay Wilder never fully recovered from until the end of the fight, where his corner threw in the towel for him, literally, and just said he's taken enough punishment, he was done. But now, as it stands, Deontay Wilder, along with exercising his rematch clause, is going to be reevaluating his corner, his team, because he did not like having the towel thrown in for him.
I mean, he acknowledges that it was like the right decision, but it's one of those things where like fighters have a lot of pride and like they don't want that done for themselves sometimes, even if it's for the best, even if it's in their best interest to, you know, to stop fighting. It's just kind of this weird warrior mentality that that maybe I will never understand if I'm not one of them. But Wilder especially, he's one of those people that he made a lot of controversy in the past by claiming that one of these days he wants to actually like kill somebody in the ring. I know it's kind of bravado, but in this point, like after this fight, he said, like, if I'm going to say stuff like that, that I want to that like one day I'm going to kill somebody in the ring, I have to be able to take that risk myself. Otherwise it's not fair, to at least, you know, market himself that way. And in that sense, I can kind of understand that, but apparently it was like the assistant trainer that threw in the towel, against, everybody else's, wishes. Yeah, apparently Wilder has repeatedly told his corner never throw in the towel. So, so this guy is now like everybody's mad at him for that. Everybody within the camp, everybody outside is like, no, that was totally the right decision because he was not coming back in that fight. He was getting pummeled by
Tyson Fury was dominating the fight pretty much from go.
Yeah, he was, like just. To start off, like Fury is a much bigger guy.
He's 6'9" and he weighed in at 270.
Yeah. And Wilder, while he's still been able to knock out guys that are bigger than him, a lot of the times they are scared of him and they're not as aggressive as they could be. And Fury was very aggressive, not just with his punching, but with charging forward and forcing Wilder to push him off and getting tangled up. And he just made Wilder.
He mixed it up with Deontay Wilder.
He mixed it up. He was willing to take punches.
He did not back down from him at all.
Yeah, he was willing to risk the one punch knockout, and got really aggressive with him. And the shots that he landed, just each one just like seemed to take a lot out of Deontay Wilder, who didn't look like he's a fighter that's used to knocking people out, so he's not really conditioned to go the full distance, even though their last fight did. While Wilder is claiming that the 40 pound outfit that he walked out to the ring in was a lot heavier than he thought. What happened was. Yeah, it's kind of disappointing to read that now, because after the fight, he seemed very like, you know, like this dude just beat my ass. Like he seemed very respectful of Fury but now it seems like he's making excuses. But I mean, if that really was a factor, then maybe I'm somewhat excited to see them do it one more time.
That was not a factor.
But the trilogy balance was definitely off. His legs were definitely bad, but I don't know. I don't think the outfit was what did it. I think he's just got bad legs in general, and he's been able to coast on the fact that he
has
such a dangerous fighter,
incredible destructive power.
Yeah. But he met his match in this fight, and now Tyson Fury is on the top of the boxing world, because as exciting as the lower weight classes have been in recent, I want to say decades, it is still nice to see you know, the two big juggernauts go up against each other like this.
And there is and we've talked about this before, there is in recent years centered around Deontay Wilder, Tyson Fury, and Anthony Joshua, sort of a resurgence in interest in heavyweight boxing. And we saw it here. And that's something that, say what you want about combat sports and boxing, the heavyweight championship of the world will always draw people's attention. And this was no different.
Yeah. And it helps when you've got two fighters that are I don't want to say both skilled, because some would doubt that when it comes to Wilder, but
they're wrong. They're wrong.
Yeah, I think he's more skilled than people want to give him credit for, but also
not just the skill, but both of them have such larger than life personalities as well.
Yeah.
And that always helps. That helps huge globally, and especially here in the States.
Until that involves you carrying a 40-pound walkout outfit to the ring.
Or saying some of the things that Tyson Fury has said.
Yeah. So it's... By the way, that outfit is one quarter of the weight that Greg Robinson got caught with weed. So just to put that back into perspective...
Oh my goodness. All right, let's move on from there. We talked about this probably our last couple of shows, but we talked about this NBA All-Star game and the new format that they had for it. I think it just kind of vastly in general, the new format was welcomed, but there have been some naysayers due to the way that the game ended. The game ended with a free throw from Lakers power forward
Anthony Davis.
Anthony Davis. I forgot. I knew it was either Anthony Davis or Dwight Howard.
Dwight Howard's not in the All-Star game, so he hasn't been in a while. So
he was in the, but he was in, he's the, in the dunk he contest, was in the dunk yeah. contest, right? Okay.
But so yeah, I think when they first announced these rule changes, I think some of us thought. I mean, I'm part of this too. I thought that this was going to be like a little bit too complicated. Like, I understood the rules, understood why they were doing it. It seemed like the reasons that I thought they were doing it were kind of like, you know, not all that necessary. And then I saw it in action, and this might have been, I think some people are calling it like the most exciting half hour of basketball in the entire season. So the way, just to recap, like the way the rule worked was that for the final quarter of the game, they shut off the clock, and then they added 24 points to whoever was winning at the time, and that became the new target score. And so whoever gets there first wins. And so we thought, okay, that's kind of an interesting way to decide who wins the game. Like, what is actually the benefit of this other than 24 points to honor Kobe Bryant? Turns out the inventor of this rule, and thank you also to Petey Rave who called in to ask us about this the first time. I wish we had addressed it a little bit more fully when he first called in to ask about it, because it seemed the real reason that this rule exists and was invented was to prevent the charade of like, you're down by a lot of points, so I'm going to foul you now to stop the clock and then make you shoot free throws and then try to run a play as quickly as possible and then foul again. And then, so the ending of NBA games take forever because they all go through that process of just foul to try to get more time on the clock, and then so now if you take away the clock, that doesn't become a factor anymore. Everybody knows what the target score is. You got to get stops on defense, you got to score points on offense, you run normal plays because you still have 24 seconds to run a play, but the overall game clock doesn't exist anymore. So you don't end up running bad plays to try to rush things. You run normal plays, and then you just end up fighting for normal possessions. But not making bad decisions or trying to rush anything or just trying to do weird things just because of the clock, because the clock doesn't exist anymore. So the way this is implemented in other leagues is that they do this when there's like 3 or 4 minutes left on the clock, usually whenever like the last TV timeout is, and then they'll add like 7 or 8 points to the higher score to make the new target score. So it doesn't end up being like a really, really long quarter. I think this untimed quarter ended up being a lot longer than a normal NBA quarter, which I don't think anybody cared because it was really exciting. But if they wanted to implement this on a more regular basis, then I think they would probably shift towards, you know, do it with 4 minutes left on the clock and add 7 or 8 points to the score. As you mentioned, Kaz, the game also ended in a free throw, which was kind of a letdown to everybody who was very amped up at the time. And then it ends on a free throw.
I don't think it was. I think for me, that still made it very exciting, right? Because it came down to those last few minutes and the game was super close and they kind of had to try to do what they could. And I just think to me, that was the game of basketball, no matter how it ended right there. And I kind of enjoyed that there's this opportunity if he misses these free throws. Right. And he claims he missed the first one on purpose.
Yeah.
But
there's still a lot of drama in like everybody's holding their breath to see if this free throw goes in.
Right.
And so, the baseline is a normal NBA game, and this was still much more exciting of a finish than that. So I think everybody kind of came in skeptical. Everybody left with, overwhelming positive vibes around this thing. And everybody's got ideas for how to not end with a free throw. Like maybe if you hit a free throw after you're fouled, then that reduces points from the other team. So then they got to work even harder to get to the target. But the game just doesn't end on a free throw. That's just one idea that's been thrown around. I think the NBA's got, I think they've kind of stumbled into a really big idea here. Like, I think this is the future of basketball. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say this. I think you're going to see this within 5 years or so, implemented in the NBA. And before then, I think you're going to see it in the G League or maybe the midseason tournament that they're talking about. Maybe they can tweak the rules a little bit, or maybe they'll try it in preseason, or maybe they'll have the WNBA try it, or like they've got options here for how they want to test this. But I think the reaction to this was so overwhelmingly positive that that they're definitely going to want to test this further. I want to say that this is, DJM is, I think, joking when he says like after double overtime, it goes to free throws. There is no overtime with the system now. There is no scenario in which, both teams can end up at the target score, because one team is always going to get there first. And so there's no overtime, which means no super extra long games, unless both teams really shit the bed in those last couple minutes and can't score at all. It's like this could end up with implications for player safety because you don't end up with these super extra long games. And so that might be a benefit for implementing this. Every single game ends on a game winning shot. That's, by definition. So endings are inherently exciting. You don't have buzzer beaters anymore, but that's not that important. I guess you still get buzzer beaters for the first three quarters. So no big deal there. You get fewer bad plays, no fouling at the end. It's just an overwhelmingly positive reaction to this. I say this is as big as the shot clock when it comes to inventions that can change the sport of basketball for the better. So maybe I'm exaggerating. Let me know if I'm overblowing this, but I think this is a big deal, and that's why I wish we would have talked about it further, because I didn't realize this at the time until I actually saw it in action.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's the reaction and then what happens in hindsight. So we saw these rules laid out, we had a reaction to it, and then after we saw the implementation of it, that's when you have your hindsight and you go, oh, you know what? That is genius. That is smart. That does play well. And I think it's one of those things we might have to see a little bit more of, like you said, in maybe some other iterations in the WNBA or in the G League, to really see how this thing could actually play out and see if it actually is the hype builder that it is kind of shown itself to be in this one game scenario. All right, going on from there, something we don't normally talk too much about, a little bit of NASCAR. But in this scenario, an actual not terrible situation. Ryan Newman was in the lead for the Daytona 500 when he got clipped, got kind of pitted, I'm going to say, after looking at the video, into the wall, and then proceeded to kind of flip, was hit by another car, and then skidded out on the top of his roof. Very dangerous looking situation at first, but you obviously think, okay, the roll bar is there, but then the car started to leak fuel and other things while it was on fire, which is what then made that situation even more scary. But he survived with a few head injuries, and was able to walk out of the hospital on his own power.
Yeah, and after a day, which I think, like, watching the crash, and I don't recommend you watch the video if you're one of those people that it gets really squeamish with crash mm-hmm. videos. But I think it's easier to watch now knowing that he survived, and it's kind of interesting to watch it from like an engineering perspective of like it's kind of amazing that these cars, like 20 years ago, like I don't, the 20 years ago, he dies three times during this crash. The first crash into the wall, maybe not so bad, but then, you know, flipping over, that would have messed him up, and then getting hit by another car going full speed on the driver's side, while he was in kind of midair.
I think partially too, the lightness of the way these new stock cars are designed is also what saves that, right? Because they're more designed not to just be these giant things that sink to the ground. Being able to hit and kind of go up and over is a thing, right? Because of the lightness of the vehicle. Whereas like if somebody just careened into him and then they were still just pushing him along the track, you know what I mean? Because they can't instantly slow down. So it allows the car to kind of lose some of that momentum, but it is dangerous that it was on the driver's side. But also the response time of these teams now to be able to get to the car, assess the situation, put out the fires, check on the driver, do all these kind of things is a lot faster than it used to be. It seems long if you're watching the video, but what you have to realize is there's usually only one or two points on the track that the teams, the trucks can get out there, from generally where they are, depending on the track design and stuff like that. So they always kind of have those teams ready, and then you have to kind of drive to that portion of the track. But yeah, there's just very good response times to these, and kind of luckily it was kind of he stopped near pit row, which. I think with Daytona, they come from the inside of the track, so it allowed them to get to him pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's, yeah, like I when he was first taken to the hospital, it was announced that he's got serious but not life-threatening injuries, which on its own was a relief because people were concerned that, or I guess the first good sign was that they didn't cover up the car. which yeah. I think is like something that they do if the driver's dead. And then they took him to the hospital. They announced that he's got serious but not life-threatening injuries, which was kind of a relief. And then turns out the serious injuries were kind of probably the head injuries that he received from flipping over and over again, which, you know, are serious. And we talk about, you know, head injuries in other sports as being serious, but it's like, you know, no other injuries beyond that, like no broken bones, anything like that. And he's able to just walk out of the hospital the next day, just, you know, while monitoring his concussion status and all that. But it's just amazing that, you know, to get in a crash like that and just still be able to walk out of the hospital the next day. It's a feat of engineering and also a testament to the sport itself, the governing bodies wanting to ensure that their drivers are in a very unsafe sport can participate safely. One of the structural additions to the NASCAR cars was one of the bars across the top that Newman himself actually recommended. So in a way, because they listened to him, his innovation was able to help save his own life so many years down the line. That's a good example of a sport listening to their athletes when it comes to what is and is not safe and how to make it safer.
Yeah. I mean, I've enjoyed NASCAR over the years and to a certain extent, the crashes are a big draw. Right. But I think it's a big draw when you kind of watch them and initially and don't know much or don't think about the human life in it. But then when you do, it kind of is something that takes you back a little bit from it. And I think when I initially started watching NASCAR, I kind of got into it for that and kind of the entertainment factor of it. But then as I kind of got deeper into the sport and past that, I found it really interesting, especially with the old point systems and things like that. So I think crashes will always kind of initially be a draw, but the fact that now you can see a crash like this and know a guy could just walk away. I think that's a testament one to, like you said, the safety precautions that they've put in place and all these kind of things. And two, knowing a little bit of the draw of your sport, right? You know, those things are going to happen. You know, people kind of sometimes tend to look for it, but at the same time, it's how do we not make this almost sending people to their death every single time for 10, 20, 30 more thousand views.
Yeah. I was surprised while watching part of the race, like how much these cars touch each other. And it's just part of the sport to just bump other cars. I know there's the joke that rubbing is racing, but this was I'm not just going to like rub against you while trying to get past you. I'm just going to nudge you from behind. I'm just going to shove you in the back. And that's just part of it. I guess when you design cars that are this safe, like you can, that becomes a part of your sport, that you can be that rough with each other and expect everybody to be relatively okay.
Yeah. Cause there was a time where there was talk of making things like that a point deductibles. Right. And then it's like, well, what am I supposed to do if a guy slows down in front of me? Like, am I supposed to then slow down? You know what I mean? Like, and it's obviously you want the speed, you want to show off the sport to the best of it. And there is some skill and some, there is a thing to it. It's a strategy to it sometimes, right? To kind of bump a guy, get him to move to one side of the track because you know you're faster on the top side or faster on the inside. So you're kind of trying to nudge him to go one way or the other so that you can then get around him. So there are those parts of it. And I think it does make up the sport once you learn those things. Because initially, it just looks like you're being an asshole.
All right. Let's move on from there to hockey.
Yeah.
With some heroics.
The doubles still suck.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. Is that not what we're talking about? Is that not what we're here for?
Do you need a goalkeeper? Because
the Red Wings,
probably
the Detroit Red Wings, continuing their tradition of excellence, are not just tanking, but they are eliminated from the playoffs way ahead of everybody else. Standard of excellence. Even when they're tanking, they tank at a high level. Go Red Wings.
Well, we're up against each other tomorrow, DGM, so that's just a game of sadness there that we can both enjoy.
Oh, that's a tank off. It's it's probably going to go to overtime. And yeah, so the San Jose Sharks aren't doing much better. They've got the fifth worst record in the league. Just a little bit worse than the New Jersey Nets. And they don't have their own first round draft pick this year. So, oops. But on a better note, the Carolina Hurricanes, who are in the playoff hunt, they were playing the Toronto Maple Leafs the other night and had to resort to the emergency backup goalkeeper, which is a rule in hockey that I always forget about until this happens.
Yeah. I was reading this, I was like, wait, what? I'm sorry, huh?
Yeah, it makes for such great moments like this, because the rule is each team can like list two goalkeepers. If they both get injured, there is like a designated backup goalkeeper, backup to the backups that can take the net for either team. You're just the backup for, you know, the building, because they expect both teams aren't going to get two goalkeepers injured in one game. So only one team is going to need this guy, and it's usually just like anybody in the building with goalkeeper experience. So in this game, it was David Ayers, a 42-year-old Zamboni driver for the local affiliate Toronto Marlies. By the way, 42 years old is the oldest that any player has ever made his debut in the NHL. So already broke a record by entering the game. He entered the game with about halfway through the second period, through the middle period. And at the time, he entered the game for the Hurricanes. At the time, he had a 3-1 lead at the time. Gave up two goals quickly, then got another insurance goal from the Hurricanes. But then in the had to play the entire third and final period, and stopped every shot that came his way at that point. Seven more shots came in during the third period. So yeah, he basically just needed to get warmed up for because he hasn't played at the professional level since the 2014 and 2015 season. And he did that for, again, as an emergency backup goalkeeper for the Norwood Vipers in that game. But yeah, it's just this weird rule that lets you just pull this random Zamboni driver and put him into the game. And it's almost like, like that's a rule you wouldn't expect to exist in real life. Like you would expect this from like a movie or something. Like,
who's taking the option on the movie for this?
It's such a storybook situation. And so he came in and won the game for the Hurricanes, 6-3. He was named the top star of the game. He is the first ever emergency backup goalkeeper to even win a game in the NHL. So, already history there. Such a big event that, that the Hurricanes kind of forgot for a little bit that they lost, you know, they had three really big injuries, including two of their goalkeepers. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to need him again because they can just call up, you know, another goalkeeper from their affiliate. But you know, just for one night, David Ayers gets to be an unforgettable part of NHL history. And on top of that, the Hurricanes are selling shirts with his name and jersey number on it, and he gets royalties from that.
Because I was going to say, he gets no money for that game though.
Yeah, I think he signed a $500 amateur contract for that game, but I mean, he did also get paid to have the memory of a lifetime.
That's crazy.
I think he gets to choose a charity to also receive proceeds from these shirt and jersey sales. I think he's a survivor of some sort of kidney disease. So I think that's what he's probably going to pick for his charity to donate money to. But yeah, just for one night, just an incredible moment for somebody who did not expect to be a part of the game at all. Check out the highlights for that. I think the Hurricanes put out a video that was like top 8 saves of David Ayers' career, and it was just all highlights from this game. So they're leaning into the meme. He's leaning into the meme. Everybody's having fun with this. The only people who are not having fun are the Toronto Maple Leafs, who somehow failed to score a goal in the final period against the Zamboni driver for their affiliate. They got a lot of soul searching to do.
Look, I just say the man's having a good time. Let him have a good time.
They also owe their draft pick to the Carolina Hurricanes. So,
all right. Well, here we go. Yeah. All right. Well, with that said,
Tankathon is a great site. It's just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
It's becoming more and more a part of my life.
Yeah,
I also because there was I looked it up. I just wanted to see what their score was at the moment. Allegedly, the Devils are on a fire sale. So if you need a player, ask the Devils because they're getting rid of everything at this moment.
The Red Wings the Red Wings traded their two viable pieces, Mike Green and Andreas Athanasiou. So just like the Pistons buying out players, the tank is on. Like, we are tanking here in Detroit. We are tanking.
In other news, for me and DJM, it's a race to the bottom in our hockey teams.
and there's a lottery system just like the NBA. So not structured exactly the same way, but it is a lottery. So you could hit rock bottom and still end up the Red Wings are 16 points ahead of the Los Angeles Kings when it comes to being at the bottom, but they could still miss out on the number one pick. They could still drop all the way down to the number four pick. So it's could be rough times ahead. Probably going to be rough times for a couple more years at least. All right. Well, we hope you guys didn't have a rough time listening to this show. We had a good time. And if you want to listen to more episodes, you can head on over to sportsoddsandends.com. You can also find the show notes there. All the links to all the stories that we've talked about here and the video clips that we've talked about. If you want to hit us up on Twitter, I'm at JVZ. Kaz is at King Kaz. DJM is at Call Me DJM. Patreon.com/sportsoddsandends. If you want to contribute financially, thank you to all the patrons who do currently support us. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.